Thank you for listening to Food End, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Amanda Balaguer. Our first episode is being recorded during Hispanic Heritage Month. The U.S. began celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month in 1988, but it first started as National Hispanic Heritage Week in 1968, when it was proclaimed by President Lyndon B. Johnson. From September 15th through October 15th, this month celebrates the traditions and cultures of all Americans who can trace their roots to Spain, Mexico, and the Spanish-speaking nations of Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. Which leads me to our first guest, Prisha Vion. Prisha is not only an alumna of the BU Gastronomy program, but she's also a chef and entrepreneur. She received a Boston University's Women's Guild Award in 2018 and the 2020 Award for Excellence in Graduate Studies from Metropolitan College. She blogs at Callow's Eyes and can also be found at Cheeky's Kitchen. Thank you for joining us, Prisha.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So as a chef, what does this celebration, Hispanic Heritage Month, mean to you, your family, and your community?
I find that today it's not a month that I'm celebrating. I'm Latina, so I celebrate this every day. I eat my food all the time. I listen to Spanish language music. I watch Spanish language TV or movies, a lot of stuff. And I think of myself as a mixed race woman, being both indigenous and of European heritage. So it's expansive to me, and I'm always consuming and sharing and learning everything from many of my communities, my chosen communities, the people around me, my family. And so it does mean a lot to us. My family is very tied to our heritage and loves to celebrate. I have a very musical family. So in normal times when we would get together, there's usually guitars that come out and singing that happens and dancing that happens. And I miss that tremendously. So the pandemic has definitely changed our family dynamic a lot in the last almost year now, right? And I miss that a lot. It's not the same on Zoom. We're not getting to taste everybody's food anymore. I'm just cooking for myself and my parents and my daughter. And so it's very different. And I do miss all of those shared moments. And as we begin to open up a little bit more, I'm happy to do some of those things again. I'm a little bit worried about the winter time and when it gets cold and people might not want to be inside anymore, but with each other. But we'll see how that goes.
Well, I can certainly understand those concerns. Speaking of the pandemic and celebrating, can you share with our listeners ways that they can celebrate Hispanic heritage and Latino heritage through food amid the pandemic?
Well, I was going to say that it's easy to do through music. One of the things one of the beautiful things about the pandemic is that many programs have gone online. And so you have these opportunities to perhaps go to shows or listen to, or like the other day, I took a samba dance class in my living room through the Cambridge dance, studio that's there in Central Square. When it comes to food, and it's interesting, I think, what has come about in terms of connecting with people in that way. It's not quite when you don't have the commensality piece involved, right? When it's only a visual and you're not triggering the other senses in a communal way, right? You're not tasting it together. You're not smelling it together. You're not cooking it together. It definitely changes the dynamic, but it can be done. I've certainly had dinners and celebrated my birthday in the pandemic on Zoom. But one of the things that I'm actually going to be involved in this weekend, which was a beautiful invitation to get, the first national Latinx Writers Conference that's out of the University of New Mexico. And I've been invited to host one of their dinners. And what that means is I'm inviting, there's about 12 people that are poets and prose writers, because I'm also a poet and a prose writer, to come to my kitchen, and I'm going to cook them a meal. And it's sort of like an extended icebreaker. So it's a way for people to either join me in cooking. So I've sent everybody the recipes in advance, and they can join me in cooking, and we can rake bread, so to speak, in that way, and also get to know each other as we partake in a variety of different workshops throughout the weekend. So this was something that I was just interested in the conference, and to get the invitation, I thought this is a really cool idea. Obviously, this would have happened in person before, and they decided, you know what, we're going to do it just exactly the same, but through Zoom, and see how it goes. And I actually think it's going to be a really beautiful shared experience if people are into it. You know, it really depends on how into it they are or how confident they feel in their cooking skills. I'm definitely, I chose something that might be outside of people's comfort zone. So we'll see.
Well, what did you choose to to make? What's on the menu for this event?
So my interest in Latin food in general and Peruvian food has definitely taken a turn in the last 5-6 years, where I've become very focused on stripping back Peruvian food to pre-colonial ingredients. And so I decided to make a dish called carapulcra, which today is usually made with pork and chicken. So it's a pork and chicken dish stew that includes a very special type of potato called papa seca. It's dried potato. And it looks like, if you've ever seen the resin for a bow, for like a violin, it looks like resin. That's how deeply dried it is. It's golden and it's gorgeous looking. And you have to like toast it and rehydrate it. And it not only has this gorgeous, deep, intense flavor, but it also changes the texture by drying it and rehydrating it. So it's a little bit of a chew. And so when you add that to the stew, it just gives this gorgeous texture and flavor. But because I'm doing pre-colonial and I'm not using chicken or pork, and I don't obviously have alpaca meat, you know, close by to throw in the stew, and I also am obsessed with quinoa, I'm using quinoa as the protein for this dish. So it's a quinoa carapulcra. And then I'm doing a purple corn drink, which anyone who knows Peruvian food pretty much knows, chicha morada. So I'm making chicha morada to drink with that.
That is classic. And that sounds amazing. If our listeners wanted to be able to make this themselves, where might they find the ingredients to make this kind of stew and the drink? And do you by any chance plan on posting the recipe anywhere, like on your blog?
They are already posted. So if you do a little search for Kahlo's Eyes and look for chicha morada, you will find a post from a couple years ago. And the vegan carapulcra, as I call it, is also there. Last year, I posted that in my blog. So you can find both of those recipes on my website. And the ingredients, I will say, and we may talk more in depth about the procurement of food during the pandemic in this case and how it's changed in the Latin community in general. But I haven't been able to find some of the ingredients that I normally would cook with. And I finally started talking to the couple of owners that have two main markets that I go shopping at that carry Peruvian products. One is in Brighton and the other in Waltham. And I finally talked to one of the owners of the Waltham market the other day, because every time I went, I couldn't find purple corn. I make chicha morada a lot and I just couldn't find purple corn. And then I noticed every week I went, like, one section would be full, but then everything else would be empty. And I finally said, what's going on with your Peruvian products? And it took me a moment to think about it. Peru, of course, has also been hit very hard by the pandemic, as has Brazil. And so food products coming from Peru, it's not getting here as easily. And so while we have a lot of distribution centers in Florida or in New Jersey, which is closer to us here in Massachusetts, it's just not getting up here quickly, and there's a shortage. So I'm not being able to find everything. However, you can, under normal circumstances, usually find any store that generally carries Peruvian products, even if it's a small section, usually will have papa seca as one of the items that you can buy. It's a brand called Inca Food. That's the brand. And so they have papa seca, they have all different kinds of Peruvian products. These are beans that come from Peru and things like that. So you can find them pretty easily. I would say that 10 years ago, it was not as easy to find these products, but now it is easier.
Connect with new friends and get updates on new events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
So let's talk about your background as a chef. I know that, as you mentioned before, it is tied in with your Latina heritage. For example, before studying gastronomy at Boston University, you majored in Spanish at Mount Holyoke, and you also studied culinary arts at Johnson & Wales, and you also received culinary training in Lima, Peru. Can you tell us about that?
So I want to say that my love of Peruvian food and of the food industry in general started as a child. My father owned a Latin American restaurant for 10 years of my upbringing, and I spent a lot of time in that restaurant. It was in Inman Square, Cambridge, before Inman Square was cool. It was when it was still mostly Portuguese immigrants and a lot of older folks before the Brazilian wave came through in the 90s. And so So it was a very different place back then. It was sort of not where people really wanted to have their restaurants because it felt very, very far away to most people. But I love that restaurant. And there's just certain sounds. As my parents were also musicians, there used to be many more restaurants that had live music. And my parents would sing and bring me. And so I sort of remember taking naps in the back dark areas of restaurants on chairs pushed together so I could lay down and listening to my parents singing and the sounds of glasses clinking and all this other stuff. And then as my father opened up, he had several different restaurants in different places. Just the whole atmosphere was so fascinating to me. It just felt like people were dancing in the kitchen, the way that they moved around each other and the sounds and the smells. And I was just very fascinated by the culture of it. People were kind of brash, hard with their language, but they were fun. And I just loved the culture of the kitchen a lot and spent as much time as I could there. I learned how to dance salsa in my dad's restaurant, and I learned how to make flan there, and all these different things. So it started way back when, but I had a profession, which I won't go into because it was kind of boring, but I did a lot of things for like 10, 12 years. And then one day I just thought, my soul is dying. I'm not meant to work in an office setting. This is just not who I am. And so I quit my whole life. This is, I was living in Western Massachusetts, and I went off to Johnson & Wales. And the reason why I chose Johnson & Wales actually was not just because it had a great program, and it does, but it was because very specifically they had a study abroad program to Peru. And I thought, this is my opportunity to know whether or not I'm preparing this food the way it's supposed to taste. Because, you know, my family's my family, and they're like, oh, this is delicious. But I'm like, okay, it's delicious, but does it taste how it's supposed to taste? When we had the opportunity to study abroad, I snatched it up, and what was supposed to be a month-long trip ended up being 6 months. I stayed there, and I lived in Lima after the program had already ended. And I remember one of the first classes we took, it might have been even one of the first days that we took, there was a chef instructor. His name is Rodolfo Tafur. Is that right? Tafur, yeah. T-A-F-U-R. He's brilliant, and he knows like a tremendous amount of information. I remember walking into this classroom, and he had this big, long table next to him, next to his podium. And it was just filled like this cornucopia of Peruvian products, just all these tubers and oyuco and oca and all these different native potatoes and corn and just like this pile of beautiful, colorful foods. And as I'm listening to him and he's sharing legends about food and the origins, the stories of origins of these foods and talking about the way people consume them and the way that they grow them. And he's just going deep into all this stuff about indigenous foods of the Andes. And I sat there thinking, all this time I've been teaching myself Peruvian food or getting my dad to give me recipes and walk me through things. Everything I've been cooking has been what you would call comida criolla or Creole food. It was mixed. It was European and indigenous and maybe African and a little Chinese. It was all mixed. And that's, of course, how Peru really markets itself as being sort of this, you know, blending of cultures and influences in their food. While I'm happy that I make all those dishes and I know how to make all those dishes, that was my aha moment where I thought, I haven't really been cooking with indigenous ingredients from Peru. Like I'm swapping things out. I'm doing this. I don't know these flavors. I don't know this. Mm-hmm. So that was my moment where that was all of a sudden, I think, where the seed of going back to school finally came in for graduate studies, because I was like, I need to know more. I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know where to start. So, that's how I ended up looking into what programs can I get into that will allow me to be the food nerd that I am, to explore my obsession with quinoa. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, what in the world? How much did I love Julia Childs and Jacques Pepin? And like, did I grow up watching them on TV and PBS? And I said, why would I not, you know, join this program? And so when I applied to the gastronomy program, I feel like many, many parts of me came together in all the right ways. Yeah.
Can I just say that I love how you describe from a sensory aspect, the sounds and what you saw, people dancing, the music, you know, I'm sure there were smells and tastes, of course, and things that you're touching, but the way that you describe food when you're in your family's restaurant, when you're in Peru, is just gorgeous and really evocative. And I love how you're bringing us there with you.
You're listening to Food And, a podcast from the gastronomy program at Boston University Metropolitan College with your host, food journalist, Amanda Belliger. Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events in food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
One of the most consequential occurrences in food history was the fact that after landing in the Americas, the Spanish explorers and conquistadors initiated the Columbian Exchange, and they brought the native foods that they encountered, tomatoes, maize, potatoes, which you mentioned before, back to Europe. And the potato in particular proved to be very adaptable. It grew quickly and it spread throughout Europe. And it even contributed to the survival of certain populations during times of food scarcity. So going back to the potato, and you mentioned all of the different varieties that you saw when that chef had them displayed in front of you for this display of indigenous foods. What role does the potato play in Peru's food identity and food culture?
It's hard to think of a dish sometimes that doesn't include a potato. There's like, you know, there are thousands of varieties of potato in Peru, and some of them are used in particular ways. So some of them are better used in soups or stews. I mentioned papa seca. There's another type of, so that's a dried potato, but there's also freeze-dried potatoes that are called chuño or more. Yeah, it depends on whether they have the skin or they don't have the skin on them still. But they, you know, the Inca and the predecessors to the Inca too, just the Quechua people in general from that area, learned how to preserve the potato in ways that could make them, I mean, I can't guarantee that it lasts forever, but I will tell you that I have had some chuño for probably 10 years. Like, I found a bag that got lost in something and I pulled it out and it still was in perfect condition and smelled great. And so there is a way in which the potato was not only, as you said, very adaptable in high altitude and lower altitudes. They had terraces that they built all throughout these insane mountains and these Andean mountains. And you have so many sizes, shapes, colors that have different amounts of sort of beta carotene, whether it's a sweet potato or it's antioxidants with your purple potatoes. You have all these different kinds of mineral components in them. And then there are all these other ways of preserving them. But some, like the white potato, is what's used to make chuño, or like you have what they call a black potato, which, you know, they, you know, people will like, they don't quite boil, they boil, but there's also sort of a steaming and what's called a pachamanca when you bury the food with hot stones in the ground and it cooks slowly in the ground. They have people who are now using oyuco or oca, which are like smaller tubers that are kind of bumpy, to make them into marmalades now. They make them as spreads. It's a part of Peruvian cuisine everywhere. And I think there's also there's a revival now of supporting more farmers in continuing to cultivate more biodiversity and honoring those many native potatoes that exist and the heirloom potatoes. And so I think there's definitely a new care and more paying attention of those potatoes now, especially like in the last few years. There's much more attention being paid to the potato.
Thank you for downloading the Food And podcast. Visit us at sites.bu.edu/gastronomyblog. There you will find select readings and books recommended by our faculty from the gastronomy program at Boston University. For example, I recommend the edited collection Food Across Borders, edited by Matt Garcia, E. Melanie Dupuy, and Don Mitchell.
You spoke before about how celebrating anything in 2020, including Hispanic Heritage Month, it's certainly different from doing so in other years, in recent years, because of the pandemic. And according to the WHO, countries in Latin America have been hit pretty hard. You mentioned Brazil. They've had over 5 million coronavirus cases. Peru has had almost 900,000 and over 30,000 deaths caused by COVID-19. On a related note, the Latino population in the U.S. has also been hit very hard. The CDC reports that over 20% of COVID-19 related deaths are among Latinos. And that's despite the fact that only 18.5% of the U.S. population is Latino. As a result, Latino community foodways have been severely affected by the pandemic. And I'm wondering, as a chef, how has your profession been affected? What are some of the problems that you've observed within the Latino food community? How has the pandemic affected you as a culinary professional?
This pandemic, while it's devastating and has been obviously devastating, especially to Brazil and to Peru and to the United States and to other countries around the world as well, I do think that it gave us this really important moment where we had to pause. And we really could have collectively as a country been like, oh, and thought about food and foodways differently and thought about like, oh, so people have been sick and our foodways have have been disrupted and we can't import export the way that we've been doing it, is this necessarily a bad thing? And in the case of the United States, if we can't import better, healthier foods, then yeah, it's totally a bad thing because we don't grow things well here. So I think that Latinos absolutely are impacted. If you're talking about urban areas where people are eating more processed food, yeah, because people were living off of more processed food because that's the stuff that was still on the shelves. When you couldn't find anything else in the supermarkets, all the veggies were low, all the milk and the stuff was low, but you could find dry milk, you could find powdered milk, you could find the sugary cereals, you could find all the canned stuff that's pumped full of sodium and sugar. And so people who were already perhaps not well and sick and maybe eating some of those foods to begin with, because it's cheaper, you know, then we're sort of forced to have to continue to buy those foods because we had shortages all around of all of the healthier foods that, of course, on the outside of the aisles. I think we were all impacted, and Latinos in particular, who perhaps in more urban settings, I can't speak for rural areas because I've never really lived in rural areas. I've mostly lived in cities in the U.S. There was definitely a shortage of being able to get healthy food for a period of time. It was always out of stock, and it was really hard. And like I mentioned earlier in this podcast, I couldn't find typical Peruvian products for a while, and I really wanted to make chicha. That's my jam. All through summer, I keep a pitcher on hand, and I couldn't do it. And luckily, I was able to find sorrel and or hibiscus and jamaica, however people call it, and I was able to use that, but it wasn't the same. And so I, you know, you find ways of making do. But I think we had an important moment. I don't think we took advantage, unfortunately, of that moment to really look at our food and our food ways and the ways in which we're sick. I think that enough food professionals, and I would say for myself in this industry, I use that moment well. And I really reevaluated what are the things that I've been buying and where do I want to put my money and my efforts into getting food? How do I want to change that trajectory if we ever find ourselves in this position again? Because the likelihood is that we will, right? So I started growing my own food a little bit. I live in an apartment and I have a porch. It's not a very big deck, but I get a good amount of sun. So I started growing some stuff that I thought I could do from seed. And I've been teaching my daughter since last year how to do little things, but today we expanded what we grew. And I thought about cooking things that are more healthy and selling some of those things. But of course, that's not what people wanted. People wanted comfort food and fried things. And I was trying not to make those things, but I chose to make some food differently. And what was really interesting in that, and I just want to share that this goes back to people in the industry undervaluing Latinos in general and our contributions, because no matter whether you're eating, literally, if you're eating Japanese food, if you're eating Chinese food, if you're eating American food, you're eating out of your Italian spot, Latinos are making that food for you. So like, we're very proficient in many styles of food. You know, we know how to make everything. And so, yeah, like maybe we might be Salvadoran or we might be Mexican or we might be Peruvian, but we kind of know how to make everything because we're working everywhere. But not only are our hands and our work and our contributions undervalued, but also our foods and our ancestral foods are very undervalued.
Thank you for sharing that, Krisha. Now, as we come to the end of our show, I'd like to know what your thoughts might be on the foreseeable future of Hispanic and Latino gastronomy. Can you tell our listeners what upcoming events or projects you personally have in the works?
I think we're at the beginning of a new renaissance in food historians, in food writers, in chefs and cooks. I think YouTube has exploded even more than it had, with many more home cooks making food making and story sharing so much more accessible than it ever was before. And people had nothing to do, and so they really delved into watching YouTube more often. But there's two cholitas from Peru that now have YouTube cooking channels, and they literally cook out in the middle of the Sierra, like with, and this one, the younger woman is so cute. She always like introduces you to her animal. She's like, so this llama is named da da da, and she's like, this is my sheep, and she's so cute. And just makes amazing food in earth ovens or ovens outside. And it's just, you get to really witness people in their elements and at home in a way. And I think people are paying attention more. So I feel like we're in a place where there's so much more. Our knowledge is going to deepen now, and we have more access. There's more content online, which helps because we can't travel as normally as we could before. So I think we have access to more information than we did pre-pandemic, and people are paying attention more now.
So before we sign off, Tricia, I want to know what does your future hold? What are you up to now? What are you planning on doing in the future? Anything you want to let our listeners know?
Sure. So I'm going to keep writing my blog. I'm going to keep this blog. It's funny. I know that I came into the blog game late where people are like kind of over blogs, but I really think about, I needed a place to document my stories for Kahlo, my daughter, and wanted to also document my recipes someplace where she would always have access to them. And I never really thought about other people reading them. Honestly, I thought about her reading them one day. And so that was the whole inspiration behind the blog. And I hope one day that she will join me in writing some of these things so that if she ever decides to have children, that language exists there for them to read too.
I want to thank you, our guest, Tricia Bion, for joining us for this episode of Food And, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. And signing off, I'm your host, Amanda Balaguer.
Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events in food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
Are you interested in more information about Boston University's gastronomy program? Students in the program examine the role of food in historical and contemporary societies from a variety of perspectives. We have online and in-person programs, including a Master of Liberal Arts in Gastronomy and a Food Studies graduate certificate. These unique multidisciplinary programs encompass the arts, the humanities, and the natural and social sciences. Visit us online at bu.edu and navigate to the Metropolitan College for the Gastronomy graduate program.